You're listening to Wide Atlantic Weird, the Irish 40-in show that's critical but not cynical, though I struggle somewhat to remain uncynical on this episode, as you will hear. This is myself talking to the indomitable and rather incredible Cameron McCormack. We're talking about cryptozoology. In fact, we're talking about what we term the limits of flesh and blood cryptozoology. Folks who are not interested in the ghostly spiritual side of cryptozoology, but who believe that we're talking and dealing with real flesh and blood animals, but whom really push the boundaries of that concept quite as far as it will go. People who postulate that there are very many different kinds of mystery animals wandering the earth, even in categories, you know, whereby you would normally say there's only a singular creature. And if you get through to the main body of the episode, I think you'll understand what we're talking about. It had been several years since I had the chance to have a chat with Cameron, and this was loads of fun. So as usual, folks, you find me here at the cabin in the woods, located somewhere in rural Ireland. I'm still inside the cabin. It's still winter. Not really the kind of time to be sitting outside. It's not warm enough yet, though. I'm starting to see more daylight finally, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel. And so I'm celebrating a relatively warm evening for this time of year, sitting back with a bottle of Guinness West Indies Porter, an old favourite. A macro brew rather than a micro one, but a welcome one nonetheless. Now, very quickly get the housekeeping out of the way. So if you want to support the show, you can do so over at buymeacoffee.com/wideatlantic. And if you want to say hi over on Instagram, we are wide_atlantic_weird. And over on Mastodon, we are wide at wideatlanticweird at home.social. Okay, that's that done. Now, what do I have to talk to you about? Just a few little things. At the end of this episode, I'm going to explain that there are changes coming to the show. I've had changes in my thinking and my feelings about the subject, and I want to take things in a different direction. I think the new direction will, I think it'll be enjoyable for listeners that we've picked up over the years. I think people who enjoyed the show as it is will enjoy the show as it's going to be, but I really do need a change of some sort. And so I'm going to be wrapping things up with one chapter of the show and going forward to another one. It will be a different title. I'm probably going to keep the same stream so that all the episodes will be still found in the same place. Past episodes will be where they always have. I don't think that's, hopefully that's not too confusing. Write into me if you have experience with this sort of thing and you have planned it badly or better than I, and I can learn from you. That would be interesting. Anyway, there'll be more about the change to the show, the kind of switch to a different gear, a different direction, after the interview with Cameron. So for more details on that, stay tuned. And I will be doing a standalone episode with a little bit more information about that as well. What am I reading at the moment? Yeah, two things. I'm still in the grips of an occasional mania, an obsession I have with the British Empire. So I am reading Empires in the Sun by Lawrence James. This comes after reading a bunch of recent books that have been very critical of the British Empire. And so returning to a kind of an old stalwart like Lawrence James after reading those books at the moment, he's coming off as rather hopelessly naive, to be honest, given better, more critical information that's come out in recent years and better, more incise books, shall we say. The likes of Lawrence James, though, I do enjoy their sort of freewheeling take on, you know, the colonial times. There's something a little bit naive, a little bit wishful about it. You know, he's definitely not as bad as a Neil Ferguson, but he's definitely a lot softer on the Empire and on colonial times in general than I would be myself. But still, I do enjoy something about these books, and I do return to them from time to time. I'm also reading The Body Snatchers, rereading The Body Snatchers by Jack Finney. An incredible book. I absolutely recommend this to anybody. If you like the old films, the 50s one or the 80s one, this is a must read. Even if you don't like them, it's a great piece of science fiction from the 50s. It's written not too long before the first film, I think, which was 1956. So a few years before that. It's a really fun evocation of 1950s small town America. The characters are really quite pleasant, which is not something you can always say during this year for books in this era. The main character is quite seems like quite a likable fella, and then the book becomes absolutely horrifying in a genuinely skin creeping kind of way. So yeah, a huge recommendation for The Body Snatchers, the original book behind the films. Well worth your time. Okay, that's enough for now. We're going to get stuck into the episode about the limits of flesh and blood, cryptozoology, with good old Cameron McCormack. Hope you enjoy this one.
We are certain that Satanism exists. It's the practice of evil.
And following closely behind this car was this unidentified flying object.
You will prove the existence of the Bigfoot or Sasquatch by bringing in a body.
I know, I can't believe it's been, I think it's been 3 years since the last time I've been on. It's
And life has changed a little bit, right?
Yeah, I have a toddler now, so my involvement, which is like already getting like a little marginal, getting pushed like really on the back burner now. Back burner I didn't even know I had on the show.
do remind us of your sort of connections to the field. We're going to be talking about cryptids here, cryptozoology. What's your background with the subject?
So I'm Cameron McCormack. I usually write under the screen name The Lord Geekington. I have for, oh God, since 2007, I believe. And I've just been writing about cryptozoology since then. I've had a few things published, and I show up from time to time as a source in different books, including what we're going to be covering tonight that I just rediscovered. But I'm media-wise, I'm on Mastodon right now as my primary social. I'm gonna reevaluate how life in the internet right now. It's a little interesting and rocky, and I'll try and get something else out there. There's a few things I'm gonna cover tonight that I kind of wanna republish and actually have it out there in non-audio format. Expand on some ideas.
Yeah, that's exciting. So we're we tossed around a few ideas in preparation for this, and I know initially you suggested we talk about the work of Mark A. Hall, who is a cryptozoologist, and I was looking to expand a little bit, and I didn't really want to be kind of ragging on one person for
the whole episode. I think we could do a little introduction to the general idea of like what his work was all about, which was essentially using cryptids to like the flesh and blood application of cryptozoology to explain just about everything you can imagine. And like it goes so far, but well, we can get into that. Like why, like, so there's always been a little bit of disagreement about what cryptozoology exactly entails. And in theory, it's just animals that have yet to be described, but source material wise, it tends to dig around a little bit and find things that could easily be alien encounters, ghost encounters, things like that. And like, it just got me thinking, like, what is the, like, how far can you apply the like methodology of like interpreting things as flesh and blood? And some of the things we'll cover are they just go so far beyond. It's topics called like euhemerism, interpreting deities as flesh and blood things. So like say like Zeus, instead of being actual magical entity, would be have been like a very powerful king or warlord in the past, that sort of idea.
Yeah. Although, so I was thinking, or we had kind of decided we might call this one like the limits of flesh and blood cryptozoology.
Yeah. I think I might have found a limit here.
Well, there you know, in recent years there's been some good material put out there about the line between flesh and blood cryptozoology and then the sort of woo stuff, and how, you know, a lot of this stuff that I think for outsiders they presume that yes, it is a you know, a version or a fringe of zoology. And there's a lot of good work been made in the last few years showing that like it's more inextricably linked with supernatural stuff than you might think, and maybe than some of the kind of progenitors of the genre would like to have thought either. But we're going to look in a slightly different corner of this and say, where are the people who are utterly convinced that this is just a zoological phenomenon?
where are they, where have they pushed that to the limit? You know, the people who don't want to go into the woo as far as they see it, but they are taking stuff on board which is forcing their zoological constructions to be kind of really pushing the edges of what strains credulity, I suppose.
Oh yeah. And there was actually just like excellent video on this topic by Trey the Explainer called The Native Bigfoot that just went really in depth about the usage of Native American oral traditions about different entities and spirits and how they've been interpreted as Bigfoot. And it really seems that there's just a massive problem, just people using anecdotes and stories and traditions.
I've got that
and just
one
like,
saved. Yeah, I will. Yeah, I've got that one saved for. I tend to take YouTube videos if they're a certain kind. I'll listen to them as audio.
Yeah.
So I've got that one saved for a car drive. But that I've been literally waiting for that one for a few years because I know he's been working on it for a long time. And you know when Michael Pyle's book where Bigfoot walks, where he like. He very bluntly and matter-of-factly points out like, yes, the native peoples believed in Bigfoot and they called him the you know, he uses certain kinds of words to describe it. And he's very matter-of-fact about it, as if it was a done deal, you know, as if this is a thing that, you know, anthropologists just accept. And so I took that literally for years, you know, because it's a wonderful book in many ways. And so I think I needed this antidote to that particular version of the story.
Yeah.
I've been excited about that one.
So I think as a way to break into our topic, there was a book in 2004 by Chad Arment called Cryptozoology. And he actually disagrees with the notion that the stone giant traditions are Bigfoot because he thinks they're a different species of clearly distinctive ethno-known creature. So he essentially interprets them as a tall, dark-colored, hairless primate. And he set up what he calls a profile. But to be fair, I'm not going to cover the Native American side of this, their anecdotes and stories, because they frankly just don't mesh with this at all. So it's just kind of like an appropriated name. And then there was another tale he had from the Meshack Browning's kids about something that kind of looked like the dog from the Invasion of the Body Snatchers on the guy's face, but with mange. that's what it describes. I'm like, I don't know where on earth he's like what that has to do with anything. But.
For an outsider or for someone who's not come across it, what is a stone giant? Is that a mythological creature or a spiritual
it,
idea?
It is. I believe it is. It's in a bunch of different cultures and it is largely interpreted as mythological. I assume there isn't any extant treatment of it, but I just didn't want to bulldoze into this topic, but it's large giants that either coat themselves in stone or are made of stone. Or so he interprets already that this is a hairless primate. So instead of any sort of stone, it's just having grayish skin. So that's already quite that's already just an enormous leap, but so to kind of bolster his idea, he uses, well, I guess there are just two remaining stories. There's one, he communicated with an author named Patty A. Wilson, and I didn't have access to their personal communication, but I cross-referenced her book, Monsters of Pennsylvania, which had the same information. And she documented what she called the Ridge Road Monster in central Pennsylvania in the 1960s through 70s. And it was a series of encounters, including a claimed photograph of what I guess you could call a creature having a skeletal head, red glowing eyes, wow, emaciated with arms down to its knees and moved like a bag of bones. And it was a little unclear exactly from Patty's perspective if this was like a flesh and blood animal or not, because there's one anecdote where the monster started to sink into the sinkhole as if being lowered somehow while wailing upwards into the sky. So wow. That would kind of hint to me that's not exactly a corporeal sighting, but Chad Arment says, it's like, nope, that's a flesh and blood. Yeah, he actually uses ghost stories and scare quotes, just like completely dismissing that possibility, even though reading it, it's not super clear from the source material if it's meant to be corporeal or not. So right there, we're kind of borderline. But then he cites another, and I'm going to story, and I do mean this as literally a story. It's from Elliot O'Donnell's 1964 book, The Screaming Skulls, and a little subtale within called The Gray Horror. And it was supposedly the author collected it in 1894, and the tale took place in the 70s of the last century, which I would assume to mean the 1770s. So if there was any sort of basis in reality, that is almost a 200 year gap from when it was took place to when it was first published. And it's kind of like it kind of reminds me of Sleepy Hollow, the Mr. Washington stories there, because it was a Dutch port on the Hudson called Grenberg, which doesn't return any Google results, unfortunately. And it has a series of nested narratives about people encountering different, or actually the same entity. One of the anecdotes actually sounded like a Brocken specter, because the narrator described it as kind of mirroring their movements up ahead of them and being kind of almost like projected and being this huge gray figure. And that actually sounds like it could be, if there was any sort of kernel of truth in this, like maybe Elliot O'Donnell was working from a Brocken specter.
Yeah, but I've had that happen to me to a minor degree, and it is quite eerie.
Yeah, I've had it happen too, and it's just like it does really kind of make the hair on your neck stand back. And but the other reports, it gets a little exotic here. The gray horror is 10 or 12 feet tall, or towers into the trees. It has a death's head or grinning skull. It's glistening gray and nude. But also, when one pair of gentlemen encountered it, it grabbed someone's face with a cloudy hand half turned to flesh. And in the last part of the story, it actually straight up haunts a house. it has phantom footsteps that it somehow emanates. And then it's like deathly mummy looking head just materializes, and they light the match and it disappears. And Elliot
I'm
O'Donnell
looking at your notes here, Cameron, and I love your drawing of this creature. If listeners are interested, I will put this probably on my Instagram, I think. So go check that out if you're happy for me to put up your various amazing notes and doodles connected with this episode. I'd be delighted to share those.
And it was
they're wonderful.
So I think Elliot kind of says it's an elemental spirit, which doesn't really sound like the language from the 1700s to me.
It
sounds very 60s when it was published. And the creature just vanished when the pit was eventually filled in that it was somehow connected to. So the there's a database of speculative fiction, and this is fiction.
Well,
it is just...
I may say about Elliot O'Donnell, because he's a well-known collector of ghost stories, some of which he straight up made up. He's an English writer of an Irish family. His name sounds Irish. And, you know, he shows up in pretty much every collection of ghost stories, especially out of copyright ones, out of date stories. And he was doing that from the end of the 19th century right into the middle of the 20th. And so he's very well known for just making stuff up when you feel like it, or at best, he's not clear about what's fiction and what's not. And it's quite frustrating. In one book, he will, because he did legitimately travel around the British Isles and further afield collecting ghost stories, and he wrote them in his books, but then he would just put one in there next to it that he'd made up and pretend like it happened somewhere real. But if you go looking for the places' names, they're not real. So
yeah,
he's a terrible source in general, because you just never know when he's making stuff up.
And like, not even doing the due diligence of looking up if the town was an actual town. It's like, so that's just completely, completely out there. And to say that something that can materialize is apparently not actually materializing, that it's actually a species of
those few stories are all from Elliot O'Donnell. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's Ellie O'Donnell, and then the Patty Wilson had her own version, but hers uses such similar language to Elliot O'Donnell. Huh. It's, I really kind of think it must have been at least contaminated by it to some degree.
And is it Chad Armand who's then like trying to make out like these are actual animals rather than?
Yeah, and he says that they are like quote unquote ghost stories and just dismisses that whole aspect. And but he does kind of couch his language a little bit. He says cryptids are classifications and not tangible in and of themselves. But he also did go monster hunting on Ridge Road for that monster.
I fancy kind of setting the table a little bit by saying, like, you know, for people who aren't too into this field, they'll have heard of Bigfoot. And like some people think there's just one Bigfoot, right? He's like this pop culture character and there's just one of them. And then you've got the version of Bigfoot supported by some researchers, you know, like your Grover Krantz and that, who would say, well, this is only, you know, I only take this seriously if it comes from the Pacific Northwest, right? It's like champagne, yeah. You know? and so, you know, I mean, Grover Krantz was on the go in the, like, from the 1970s. And so he would frequently not take seriously any cases that were from anywhere else in the US. And because he just thought, like, look, I can get with the idea of an undiscovered creature in a place like the Pacific Northwest, where there's, you know, wide open spaces and lots of forests and stuff. But like, he thought that Bigfoot's, you know, showing up in, you know, being reported in more populous places, he thought that was a bit silly. And then you get some kind of a change, don't you, in the certainly by the 1970s, when you have John A. Keel writing about, you know, Bigfoot type monsters like all across America. And I suppose by the time the Boggy Creek movie comes out, you know, which kind of solidifies the idea of these creatures being in other places other than, you know, where the legend started off, which is Northern California and Washington State and places like that. So I suppose to me there's different versions of, you know, the way there's like hard science fiction and soft science fiction, you know, being with like how willing are you to like just fluff the science and just do stuff that's fun. I feel like there's hard Bigfoot science, which is like, we only take this seriously when it's happening on a scale which we consider believable, versus, you know, there's Bigfoot in every single state, and there's Bigfoot in, you know, highly populous states and places where he shows up in your backyard when you live in, you know, the suburbs of DC and this sort of thing.
Yes, and that's that's a perfect segue into the Mark A. Hall, Lauren Coleman, and Patrick Hugh situation, because. So the Grover Krantz and I guess now Jeff Meldrum concept, yes, of Bigfoot. So they have that, and they call it a neo-giant, which they, a term they borrowed from Ivan Sanderson. Do not know the etymology of that. Do not know why it's
Mark A. Hall and Lauren Coleman calling sort of Grover Krantz's initial Pacific Northwest Sasquatch. They're calling that neo-giant, is it?
Yeah. And okay. It seems to be conceptually just about the same as what Krantz was saying. And
so I've got a book called The Field Guide to Bigfoot, which is Lauren Coleman and Patrick.
Oh, yeah.
is that what we're talking about here? Is that the kind of thing we're talking about?
Yep. And it's expanding on ideas Mark A. Hall had earlier in the, I guess like since 1992 or so.
So this is the idea that there's not just one species. There's like,
oh yeah,
many species. And is this really an attempt to like justify the variety in like the inconsistency of sightings?
Yeah. So
is
the
what's going on here?
It's like this, so the like Bigfoot turning up in most of like North America. So Hoovelman's actually had a second Bigfoot on his 1986 cryptid list. He described as a chimpanzee like animal. And this incorporates that as well. They call them mapes or North American apes.
Oh yeah. And isn't that what do the North American, what's that group called? NAWAC? North American Wood Ape? No, they call it the Wood Ape, of course.
Yeah, oh yeah, there's so many different variants. Yeah, this was the idea was like there's a second type that's more chimpanzee like. And this Beast of Boggy Creek seems to be a pretty classic example of it. And this is skunk apes are a pretty familiar idea of that. Okay. So it's like a more eastern, more ape-like species also present in North America.
So Hoovelman's lumped all those. He said, right, there's, you know, West Coast Bigfoot, and then there's you know, your everything from Boggy Creek to the, you know, the swamps of Florida there at second type. Is that, was, does that come from Huvelman's?
Yeah. He was citing Mark, or he was citing Lauren Coleman as a source. And I think Coleman and Hall were working together and spitballing ideas together. And it wound up in Huvelman's. But yeah, they it kind of fractured a little bit from there, because believe it or not, North America in this the viewpoint of this book has seven other types of hominids.
Wow.
Which is, yeah, it is it has more great apes than Africa as we understand it right now in the like Washington state. So they have what they call marked hominids, which are taller than people and have weird hair. There are Neanderthal men, like, and there was one erectus, like Homo erectus, that was brought over illegally, so I'll count that one. And
illegally.
Yeah, that was the Minnesota Iceman. They say that's
of course, that's yes,
like that's a different species.
Bozo, isn't that what Huvelman's
yeah.
called him? Or was that Sanderson called him Bozo?
Sanderson, yeah.
how unfortunate. Wasn't bad enough that Sanderson calls the giant humanoid type things, he called them the ass. Remember this aquatic swamp?
Oh my god.
Something. He wasn't afraid of giving these things like really silly names.
Oh, look, swamp slob, right?
Oh yeah. Or was that John A. Keel?
I think that was Keel.
It was Keel, yeah. Forgive me. I'm mixing up all my my researchers. So we're onto like six or eight different like species here now at this point, right?
Yeah. And like, you know, the morphology of the erectus or the Minnesota Iceman is like, doesn't really match anything in North America. So I guess it's a different species.
And this so is all within North America, right? All these.
Yeah. And worldwide, it's even wilder.
Because it's fairly common, isn't it, in among cryptozoological thinking that other species in like Russia or the Caucasus, that those are, there's a line of thinking that says those are surviving Neanderthals, right? It comes from them. What's the researcher? There was a woman who wrote about this in the 1960s.
Editing key in here. The person I'm trying to think of right there is Mary Jean Kaufman, a French-born Russian cryptozoologist.
And yeah, there's like the worldwide, they kind of split the Almas and Almastes into
three.
They split them into three different species of hominids, which is, so the Russians have the marked hominids, which are bigger, and then in Mongolia they have Homo erectus, and then in elsewhere in China and even Europe they have Neanderthals still roaming around. Yeah, it's crowded.
Yeah, that is the word for it. Yeah, this worldview feels crowded to me. You know, I liked the sort of Grover Krantz idea, which is like I can my sense of disbelief can take, you know, the occasional or even a singular type of being in a place which is like unusually underpopulated, you know.
And they the categories they have too, they call them classes, and they actually they don't seem to be limited to just one species either. So like the apes and stuff, there's all sorts of goofy apes even in like Australia, and in Africa there's one that's 8 feet tall with elephant ears, and it's in North America they say like, oh, the different classes can hybridize and make something like the Missouri monster. So kind of give you a flavor of where we're gonna head.
It kind of feels like they've been challenging themselves to like, listen, you have to take every sighting seriously.
Yeah.
No matter how goofy it is, and fit that into your zoological system.
Oh yeah.
Rather than entertain the possibility that maybe it's just a story, especially these one-off, you know, these one-off creatures that don't match any other patterns. And like, you know, for me, some of the better writing on cryptozoology does things like, you know, collect sightings of things that do seem to be the same thing, and then try and figure out like, is there a consistency in how the animals are reported, and stuff like that. You know, I mean, I know you rarely get enough sightings to be kind of any real statistical significance, but at least those kind of books are moving in that direction. You know, like Healy and Cropper, when they write about the Australian animals, which I know have their own mystical side and are kind of hard to take seriously for other reasons, but I always liked their book about the Yowie, because they until the very end, when they kind of show their hand and say, look, we think there's something mystical going on here. They do a fair attempt at kind of taking it in a hard science direction as much as they can before realizing that it's impossible.
Yep. And this, so for example, they have giant monkeys in North America that the authors connect to the species Cymopithecus somehow. And it is, it fills in reports of kangaroo-like animals. And I assume it also covers dogman reports of something with like upright with kind of a dog-like face. They don't really spell it out anywhere, but that's that seems like the obvious conclusion. And they also live in abandoned houses in some populations where coonskin caps with antlers. And this is a species of, so in order to explain scary looking things with antlers, they're like, well, it's actually a species of, well, this was Mark Hall. They are actually a species of baboon that wears ceremonial antlers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is there a type of bipedal cryptid that like wears check shirts, like plaid shirts? Is that?
They have the Neanderthal type in Western North America also wears clothing quite a bit. I'm not sure. And the true giants wear clothes too, but I'm not sure about where the other, what Lauren Coleman considers that plaid shirt wearing one to be. It almost looked like a traditional like neo giant Sasquatch, which would kind of be, it seemed to be like in the middling scale and not really be
maybe
human
one
imitator.
That just, killed a hunter and
yeah. And there's a big recurring theme of them, the different like classes, like imitating people to certain degrees. And I might have to get into the true giants now, which the neo giants, they say that's not Gigantopithecus, the largest known fossil ape. That's just like Paranthropus or a robust Australopithecine or something. That's nothing. They have the real big primates, which range from about 8 feet tall in Hawaii to 27 feet tall in California.
Oh, wow.
And this, and Mark A. Hall has written very extensively on this, and he says they're pretty much fully sapient, and they can do, and in the past they were capable of doing things like having language, even like blacksmithing. They're just like essentially like a convergently evolved species of human from like a totally different primate that also happened to be absolutely gigantic. So I bet you're like, and they also think that they're extant today too. And this is, so there was, there are like a few instances of tracks. They're like pretty large, like in the degree of like 2 feet to 40 inches long, that have a reduced number of toes, like four toes or sometimes three toes. It's like, it's actually like a pretty interesting pattern because they have tracks from Malaysia and Tajikistan and Pennsylvania and like Oregon and stuff. And it's like, well, this is pretty weird that like, I've never heard of tracks that were 30 inches long with four toes. That's like, even though there aren't a lot of them, that's like, that's an awfully, awfully strange thing to be reporting. And that's, but that is about the extent of the physical evidence.
Editing Kian here. After we recorded, Cameron was good enough to send me on some additional material. So talking about the true giants, he said, I should have better explained the purported true giant footprint morphology that has been claimed. The four toes are even in size, and I even managed to track down one source. Now, this is important, especially given where the conversation goes shortly, where we sort of imply that a lot of these archetypes of creatures kind of seem to be made of whole cloth and don't have a lot of evidence behind them. And so Cameron was good enough to actually track down an origin for this, predating the book that we're talking about. So I'm going to have to back down somewhat on that, which is, what scientists are supposed to do when they're when they get a hold of fresh evidence. So this comes from the Straits Times, 12th of February, 1961. The headline is called That Footprint. And this is from, of all places, a Malaysian newspaper.
This is a close-up of a huge footprint said to have been made by a monster roaming the jungle around Kluang in Johor. Six such footprints, which look like those made by humans, have been found at a plantation near Kluang. Each is 30 inches long and 13 inches wide. And there is a photograph as well. So I'll put all that stuff in the show notes.
I've never really seen the tracks compared. Like, do they actually look at all alike? Are they all just like, are they human-like? Are they just big squares? Like, some of the larger ones are like, I almost wonder from the description if they're just fossilized dinosaur tracks at that point, is 40 inches like a meter. That's wow, just so big. That's like, that is like Grover Cranston never heard him talk about anything. That, no. But like, where's that on his bar graph? 40
he'd,
inches.
He'd furrow his prosthetic ape man brow ridge for that one.
Oh yeah. So physical evidence, and even there are a few anecdotes of very tall heights, but I have to say they're pretty unimpressive. It just sounds like exaggeration. So primarily the sources used go a little more mythological, and one of the examples of these of true giants is the Great Gray Man of Benbecdui, which
I was close to there last summer. Yeah,
yeah,
I was in the Cairngorms.
I didn't see any large tracks. Well,
I did. I did wake up in the middle of the night when we were camping and accidentally Brock inspected myself with a light.
Oh,
and I saw this. I got up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night and this huge gray man appeared in front of me and scared the hell out of me.
Did you hear any Gaelic things spoken to you?
And not from mysterious beings in the air, which is reputed to happen there. Yes.
So. Yeah, the Great Gray Man of Benbecdui is used as an example of a true giant. In the later days, they're still kind of hanging around. We've gone a little bit feral, but then they say in the past, the true giants of Scotland were the Jotun of Norse mythology, and that apparently Scotland was Jotunheim, and I guess also Iceland too. Hmm. So this is they're kind of moving pretty far into a certain direction. They call true giants the universal giant. So basically any story about anything tall in humanity's past worldwide is actually a memory of us hanging out with Gigantopithecus and maybe having a few disagreements. So they actually rolled stone giants mythology into being true giants. So take that, Armit. Polyphemus of Greek legend. That's a true giant. Probably just got the number of eyes wrong.
Oh, but yeah, he was the Cyclops, wasn't he, in the Odyssey, yes.
But they do place a lot of importance. They say in the modern days, true giants are hard to find because they just roll really, really big boulders in front of the caves. So you can't really see them, and you can't move the boulders out of the way. So that was kind of inspired by Greek legend there. But
it's kind of starting to feel like fan fiction. It's a bit like when Alan Moore is like, you know what, every Victorian fiction character is real and lives in the same universe, except it's like monsters from legend. They're all, we've got space for them all.
Yeah, this is taking it about as far as you can imagine. They even in the True Giants book, they Goliath, the Nephilim, King Og from the Bible, they are. You hemorrhized into being big apes. So I would say this would probably be a lot more enjoyable if it was written as fiction. I mean, it is an intriguing concept of like humanity had a different competing species that we had to deal with, and they were just kind of always around and imitating us, but just we had some big falling out at some point, and they're just kind of relegated to hanging out in caves and leaving.
I can see there's some even more bizarre creatures coming up. So before we do that, I just want to take a moment and think about like some of the folks involved in the creation of this sort of categorization system. Like they know what they're doing. They've been writing about this stuff for decades. They have done serious, travel data collection. You know, people who know the field very well, and I suppose I'm wondering as we go through all these categories, like before we go off the deep end a little bit, like you know, the way some researchers have a kind of a pet creature, and you're kind of like, you know, you're proud of yourself that you found this thing, or you've made your career on it, you know, or you're the first person to write a book about it, you know, and this was any number of researchers spring to mind, you know, with, you know, like, let's say a phenomenon that isn't that old, like the modern dog man that we know, you know, it's associated with a particular writer in a particular time and place, really. And so, and when you look before those first books that first present a particular idea, the evidence is usually pretty thin. And so in some of these cases, like, do you get the feeling that they're just, are these creatures unique to these writers in this book, or are they using evidence that has been reported from other places? Have other people reported these things? And I know they're classifying them in a way which is unique to them, but like, you're talking about these particular kinds of footprints, and like, do they show up in other literature?
I've never seen those footprints mentioned anywhere else. As far as I can tell, they're just completely stonewalled out of existence. So I kind of get, like, reading Hall's books, he's always kind of like complaining about no one paying attention to this, like the scientific community won't accept this, but I almost kind of think the cryptozoological community isn't even accepting this. It actually is, like, inconvenient evidence, so to speak, because it makes, on the face of it, it makes absolute.
If cryptozoology has bifurcated into, you know, people who are unapologetically into the woo, your quantum Bigfoot people, that sort of thing, and then you've got your descendants of Grover Krantz, you know, who are holding on to the idea that there's, yes, is a real creature, like, and I put Nowak in there, as far as I know from their public statements anyway, they are into the idea that, yes, there's just probably one kind of creature, and it's rare, and it's only found in a few places, and, you know, its numbers aren't very big. You know, if you've got those two extremes, like, neither group, I think, are comfortable with this like system that we're talking about now, are they? This hasn't left an impact on the field, really. It's speculative, isn't it? Even amongst cryptozoologists,
yeah.
This is like speculative zoology.
Yeah, this is just like a really, really odd middle ground that doesn't really seem. The amount of like mentions of this, like even on the internet, are just like completely minimal. It's just like,
yeah,
and I know the book had good circulation too, but like, I mean, it is kind of, I would definitely, like, I sympathize with flesh and blood interpretations the most, and definitely when I was reading this book 25 years ago, I was definitely a little more open to the idea of it, but like, once again, kind of like the Hoovelmans, like, was I like the one of the only acolytes of this stuff? like everyone else seems to have just been reading it, it just kind of never diffused, and it seemed like it feels like very lonely to have this kind of,
like, you know, Dougal Dixon's work or something. It feels like, you know, some people just playing with the ideas of zoology, you know, almost as a thought experiment.
Oh yeah,
like there aren't groups of people trying to prove this stuff is real as such, the way there are, you know, a hardcore of people still following the flesh and blood, one type of Bigfoot, you know, in a small area kind of thing.
Yeah, this is definitely a speculative evolution, but just for whatever reason, I mean, this would have made an amazing book if it was like, took place in some alternate world or something where North America actually has all these primates and, like, trying to sort out, like, what's going on here? Like,
I'm not a paleontologist. Is it true that the fossil record for apes in general is remarkably poor?
Yeah, the ape side of it is pretty, I think since they were living in tropical forests for most of their existence, it does seem like it was pretty poor. And Gigantopithecus is only known from four mandibles and a few thousand teeth, and all from porcupines dragging them into caves. So,
and what's the current, I know he's been conceptualized in different ways over the years as either a, you know, a primarily quadrupedal or a bipedal, or what's the current thinking on Gigantopithecus? For, if people aren't aware, that was the preferred explanation for Bigfoot by Grover Krantz, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is a stem orangutan, and it diverged from orangs about 8 million years ago.
So after recording, Cameron got in touch with some extra information about Gigantopithecus, saying that
Let's see now. So Gigantopithecus separated from orangutans actually more like 10 to 12 million years ago, and sent on the citation for that. And also talked about links between Gigantopithecus and the hominid Paranthropus, in saying that though they had similarities and it has been thought occasionally that they might be related, this is in fact an example of convergent evolution, and that the similarities are in fact quite superficial, with a citation from Zhang and Harrison from 2017.
It's quite a bit. How much it exactly resembled an orangutan is kind of up in the air. The known jaw morphology is very, very different from orangs. It was presumably doing something very different. And one of the recent publications that reviewed it said it has some mechanical similarities to Paranthropus, not so convergent. But, you know, that's like, there's no evidence it was bipedal. That just seems like it's, I don't know exactly how one would make that. Oh, Grover Krantz found a way to make that conclusion from bones, but how exactly, I just don't think anyone's taking that seriously. So it's presumably a largish ape. And I do have to say my good friend and dentist, Marcus Buhler, examined the Gigantopithecus mandibles, and he was pretty shocked at how small they were. Because all the stories about them being 9 feet tall, it's like, no, they're he's like, no, there's no, they're just a little bit bigger than gorillas.
Oh, that's disappointing.
unless you take the Mark A. Hall approach and say, well, they just have very small mandibles for their size. They're 27 feet tall. For their size.
And there's that whole incredible story about the tooth being found in an apothecary in where was it, like Hong Kong or something?
Yeah, grinding them up into dust,
being put in a jar and buried in a garden for the war and during the war and dug up afterwards. So I hope that's true.
Oh my god, those scientists burying those bones again, you know.
Yeah, trying to hide it, trying to hide the evidence from the Japanese. Right, so yeah, so we better dive into the element of this, which even the authors admit in the introduction, that is a little out there, and they've gotten some flack for it.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
The mer beings.
So much like the true giants, this is an example of like hyperdiffusionism, I'd say. Just one culture of primate, instead of like being a culture of people spreading everywhere in the world, this is a bunch of primates being everywhere in the world and explaining some aspect of humanity in our stories. And this is, once again, it's linked to a specific fossil genus, Oreopithecus. And every mermaid sighting is an ape in a costume, essentially.
Jeez.
So, yeah. So stories, there was one myth about an entity called the Decapitator, which was part shark, part ray, and part sea lion. And the conclusion was that it was a costume of those different species. They're also responsible for lizard man sightings, which they make the lizard, or they make the scaled hide out of alligators that they farm. The Dover demon is an example of a mer being out of costume. And I think the ultimate euhemerism here is William Glenading had an account of encountering the devil in the late 1700s. And it is interpreted as a mer being visiting the door of a house by the authors. And I'm going to say that right there, that is the limit of flesh and blood. Literally, the devil is an ape in a costume, an aquatic ape in a costume somehow. And yeah, I'm just on it. I don't want to spoil too much of the book. It just came out, but I just had, there's more like that. And I just had my mouth agape most of the read, even as an experienced reader of these texts. It was absolutely astonishing where it was going with the conclusions. I'm like, that's, yeah, we've done it. We've hit peak like flesh and blood primates are just, I'm kind of surprised they weren't piloting UFOs at this point.
So when you say it's, which book has just come out? That's because I'm getting most of this from Field Guide to Bigfoot and Other Mystery Primates. That's what the book I have from which I know this kind of system from.
This was by this was a book called Merbeings by Mark A. Hall, Lauren Coleman, and David Gutzwaard. And
it's just come out.
Yeah, really expands on the Merbeings, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody. It was extremely entertaining. It's like a speculative book, but holy smokes, it just does not occur in our reality whatsoever. It's completely off the deep end.
Yeah, I think that would be like the Dover Demon is a mermaid in a costume. I think that would be too much for most cryptozoologists.
Yeah. It's like, where, like, how are we getting this many layers deep of it's specifically Oreopithecus, and like, oh my gosh.
You know, I bet if you asked like any of these folks, like, is this woo, you know, like some of the stuff is so out there that you know it's is it as silly as quantum Bigfoot? Yes, but in a different way. And I'm sure if you ask them, they would say no, this is just proper zoology, you know, we just haven't discovered all these things yet. And yet it's so out there. It's neither the woo nor the Grover Krantz, like not your father's Bigfoot.
I'll just keep imagining, like, if you ask someone in the 1700s or like hey, Thomas Jefferson, what do you think about a Bigfoot living around your area or an unknown primate? You just, like, it would just be completely unthinkable. Like, especially in the Eastern North America, this is this is pretty known land for a while. Is
Do you know that book that came out a few years ago about Bigfoot cinema, like movies that have
Bigfoot? I haven't read that one.
Hi folks, the book I'm trying to think of there is The Bigfoot Filmography by David Coleman. No relation to Lauren Coleman, that's just a coincidence. I want to, because I know the author made a statement which was of interest to this conversation. I might have to Bigfoot at the movies? No. Can't remember. Anyway, I think it was probably Monster Talk, and he said that, where was I now? Yeah, he's talking about the Boggy Creek movie, right? The Legend of Boggy Creek, which is really funny to me because my friends growing up in Cork and Ireland, we found the second Boggy Creek film, the Boggy Creek 2, The Legend Continues, which is rubbish. It's absolute junk. And we found it for like, you know, £2 in a charity shop, and we watched it. We thought it was hilariously crap. And I literally trace our obsession with bad movies to that film, and we still have in jokes about it. And it was, you know, that was a long time ago. It was it wasn't for years that I found out that the first one is actually held in high regard, you know, amongst, you know, monster movie fans and cryptozoology fans and people of a certain age who were really scared by it. And I also didn't know that, like, it just was flabbergasting to me to find out that it was considered this kind of landmark movie, you know, as a one of the highest grossing, you know, independent films of its day. And but in this interview, which I'll probably insert the name of the person, said that that film kind of took Bigfoot out of the faraway distant places, you know, and put him into your backyard, you know. So the whole concept of Bigfoot appearing in a much wider range of places was kind of put in the public imagination by that film, because in the film, you know, Bigfoot sticks his hand in people's windows and when they're just at home, and, you know, he goes around people's backyards and that sort of thing. So it kind of changed the tone of where people expected to see these animals.
Yeah, they're just, especially in the 70s, looking through the reports, it's suddenly Bigfoot is everywhere.
Yeah, I'd like to get a handle on exactly when that change happened, because, you know, you can fairly clearly say that, you know, in the 20s there are stories associated with you know, J.W. Burns and the Canadian Northwest, and then, you know, in the late 50s you've got Bigfoot in Bluff Creek in Northern California. But how soon were people reporting it, you know, all over the place, you know? How soon did that change happen, and who were the responsible writers who first kind of picked up? So I wonder if they you know, if in days gone by, you know, every state had their silly little monster stories like the Hodag and that sort of thing. And, you know, they come from campfire culture. They come from logging, you know, logging store hunters, big tall tales, that sort of thing. There's any number of sort of folkloric, you know, grounds out of which these stories could have sprung from. But when did somebody say, oh, it's Sasquatch, you know, and the monster that people report in like Missouri or, you know, Florida, oh, that's Sasquatch, you know, when was that application made? I wonder.
There was definitely by Ivan Sanderson's Abominable Snowman book. He mentioned pretty briefly like Sasquatch or Bigfoot's in like Illinois or so. Even then he was talking about, I think he used the phrase even Sasquatch in the suburbs for California. So even by then it was kind of creeping a little bit out of
that's only 3 years after Bluff Creek, you know, or the Wallace footprints.
He didn't really expand on it very much, but it was definitely the seeds of it were planted there. And I mean, there were tons of like wild man sightings and such all over in the like late 1800s, like all up and down the East Coast. Sure, yeah. And but they, yeah, I mean, they were to the degree they were the same thing as Bigfoot is. that's another cultural question that I'm probably best for a folklorist to determine, because
that is another element I'm fascinated by. Like, to what degree are those stories, you know, compatible with post 1958 Bigfoot, you know, because you're right. Yeah, they were reported from all over the place. And they had a much wider range than, because I don't think they came with the baggage of like an attempt to make it have zoological sense. You know, they were just more like folkloric monsters. Like if you say, oh, there's a troll who lives over the bridge, you know, there's no pressure on you to have that make zoological sense. But you know, once people like John Green got a hold of the California Bigfoot, there was this kind of need to describe it in ways that seemed biologically plausible. And then they returned to those, you know, more widespread kind of frontier stories, which were, you know, a lot of them were just like made up by frontier newspapers, right? That was the culture of the time. And they revisited those and said, well, this thing that they used to call, they would call them gorillas very often, wouldn't they? Wild men or what have you, or mountain
devils. Must have been after the description of gorillas that something really struck the popular imagination, because that term really got thrown around.
So what does that be? We'll come to a conclusion, I suppose. Does this idea show up anywhere? Who are the contemporary flag wavers for this idea, or has it kind of vanished?
I think
Mark A. Hall died a few years ago, didn't he? So you say this book has just come out, but he's like, I presume it was written some time ago.
Yeah, it seems that it was kind of collected from his notes. And I can't really think of anyone expounding theories like that. I mean, there's always going to be people interpreting things as flesh and blood, but yeah, Hall's ideas were just as extreme as you can get. He did believe in, he does seem to believe in UFOs as well. And he was like, he says like Mothman is a giant owl, but the Flatwoods Monster, he thinks that's some sort of atmospheric entity. So
I had a look at some of his old newsletters you sent on. As early as the 90s, he was a climate denier. So he's not in my good books there. Not the best thing you can be.
He was definitely into denying all sorts of things. And those Wonders publications. And I actually do have a signed copy of one of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I forgot to mention I completely forgot the True Giants book actually cites me for information about the fossil Meganthropus. Yeah, I completely forgot about it. Like, oh geez. Kind of like gave me a start there. Like, yeah, I didn't.
Oh, wow. So explain this a little further. Explain what was written about you?
I was collecting just like information about the fossil primate Meganthropus, which was it was also interpreted as a giant person, but now it's interpreted as a another orangutan relative that was alive until pretty recently. And for whatever reason, I was the one being cited I think it was a Lord Geekington article where I collected as much information as I could.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Like, holy smokes. Like, I made the big leagues.
that's life goals right there. We might wrap up by saying that the Field Guide to Bigfoot is written in the style of an encyclopedia or like a wildlife book that you might carry with you as you're spotting things in the woods.
Yeah.
And so each animal has a page with a picture and a kind of a classification and stuff. And I think as a younger person, you yourself were so taken with this idea that you took it upon yourself to create an extra addition to the bestiary. would you feel like telling that story?
Oh man, so yeah, it was so implanted into my psyche that like I still have. I imagined that I found a copy of some forbidden copy that had extra hominids in it, and they had a super true giant that was even taller, and it was attacking. It was in Hawaii, and it was 65 feet tall. I'm like, oh my god, it was so vivid, and it had that like. I had that Lovecraftian protagonist feeling where I just find something. I'm like, oh my, this is forbidden. I should not know about this. It was just like the silliest thing ever. It was like a humongous ape in a fake copy of that field guide. So yeah, it's definitely made quite, and I had to recreate it from as best as I could, but I just couldn't get that. It's really tough getting that like eldritch feeling of like, no one can see this. I know about this and I'm in horrible danger.
Like, but I must keep writing.
Yeah, but I know the back had like notes on it too. Like here I am.
I'll put a picture of that. Thank goodness you still have it. I put a picture of that in the notes and on the probably on the Instagram as well, so folks can check that one out. Right. We'll wrap up, I suppose. Is there anywhere you're online or is there any work you're doing that you'd like people to know about or people to find you?
If you're on Mastodon, come and find me. I'll have to dust off the blogs at some point, but I'll try and get those all in order and so everything's searchable. Apparently, citation worthy in books still.
Tremendous. That was loads of fun. Cameron, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Cian.
Okay, folks, hope you enjoyed that. I have a bit more housekeeping and a few things that have happened in the interim to let you know. And I, as promised, I will let you know about changes coming to the show. So what's happened? Recently, I watched a film called The Wonder. Maybe you've heard of this. And this is a historical film with kind of supernatural elements or supernatural themes. Florence Pugh plays a nurse during the... Well, I think it's in the 1850s or 60s, so it's about 20 years after the Irish famine. But it's definitely a film, you know, about the famine, and famine is one of its themes because she's an English nurse from the Crimea, so shades of Florence Nightingale there, and she travels to a small town in Ireland to meet a young girl who supposedly is exhibiting a miracle, a Catholic miracle, because she's not eating and she is able to survive without eating. So again, yeah, the themes there already of famine are very strong. I think scholars of the Fortean might enjoy some of the sort of aesthetic choices in the film, how it looks and also how it sounds. The soundtrack and the titles and the closing credits are all very 70s paranormal. So if you're a fan of old shows like In Search Of and that sort of thing, I think the folks behind this film definitely were, because some of that subsidiary material and the way it's presented is very reminiscent of 70s paranormal stuff. Some of the politics of the film, I'm not 100% sure I understand or am on board with. I'm going to go back and watch it again sometime and maybe give my thoughts on it. But I did enjoy it the first time around for sure. I'm gonna put a link to a few things. In the episode with Cameron, we discussed the new episode, YouTube episode from Trey the Explainer, and I have listened to it now because I don't have a whole lot of time for long form YouTube in my life. I tend to download the episodes and listen to them when I'm driving or running or whatnot, and so I have listened to it, and I think it's really wonderful. I think people who like this show, especially my early years when I had more time for research and that, That's the stuff Trey does really, really well. I'm not surprised it took him 2 or 3 years to make this episode. And it's all about, you know, how do cryptozoologists make use of supposed Native American stories about Bigfoot? And, you know, are they right too? So there's some really good original research in this, which is something that you don't always see in cryptozoology. So I think listeners will enjoy that. I'm also going to put a link to Blake Smith from Monster Talk has a wonderful article about the Kentucky Goblins, which came out recently. And I know that's a case he's been obsessed with for years. So always good to see his writing on that. And I enjoyed it as well. I want to say thanks to Matthew, who I recorded with some time ago, for his podcast, Commendable Commotion. That episode has come out. I will put a link to it as well. So I had fun. That's me talking about the paranormal, my interest in it, and how my feelings about it have changed over the years. So I'll put a link to that. Now, the main thing, White Atlantic Weird is going to change in the next few weeks, probably. And it's going to become the Lost Valley Podcast. So let that sit with you for a moment. Why is this? It is because, firstly, I need a little something to kind of shake up my interest and reinvigorate my interest. I'm very proud of all the things I've achieved over the last few years and all the friends I've made and the sort of wonderful and talented and skilled commentators on the subject who have been good enough to come on the show. I couldn't possibly have imagined when I started off that I'd be able to, you know, have people of such caliber chatting and commenting and being part of the show. So all of that is wonderful. I have achieved almost everything I really wanted to, and I've kind of come out the other side. I don't have the time in my life to put into episodes the way I used to. And while I've benefited from amazing people being on the show, you know, those old episodes where I was able to, you know, do loads of research and just talk it all through myself. And I miss that, but it's not something I have a lot of time for anymore. So I need a little something to change, and it'll change the direction, but only a slight one. So the Lost Valley Podcast, what is this going to be about? I'm toying around with various bylines for this, but it's going to be something like Lost World, ideas of lost worlds in lore and literature, something like that. So taking as my center point something which has been an obsession over the last few years, even on the show, which is, of course, Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World and Lost World narratives in general. So Lost World and Lost Race, that means anything to do with dinosaurs, Lost Valleys, Lost Races, Arthur Conan Doyle, H.R. Haggard, all of that sort of thing. Even going up as far as stuff like Indiana Jones, but I see this primarily as older. And the whole history of Lost World literature through and all the strange ideas that fed into it, anything to do with exploration in the 19th century, early 20th, that sort of thing. Do I have enough material in there to do an ongoing podcast? I've been compiling lists of stuff I want to talk about, and I think the answer is yes, absolutely. And the good news is I've kind of come to consider cryptozoology as really a subset or even a subgenre of Lost World literature. I really, really do. And I think the seeds of that are in the work of Bernard Heuvelmans, who is kind of the father of the genre. And he flat out says it in his initial book in the 1950s on the Track of Unknown Animals. He says there are lost worlds everywhere. And I'm very, very interested in how something which was overtly fictional seeped into real life, or at least had people, you know, trying to ape it and make it into real life. We're also going to be talking about Lost Worlds on film, you know, with the whole career of Willis O'Brien, how King Kong got made, the various sequels and semi-sequels to King Kong, all of the failed projects that Willis O'Brien had over the years. We might even get into the work of Ray Harryhausen there as well. So look, there's lots of different places and directions we can go with this. If you have ideas, if you have favorite stories of lost worlds, lost races, lost valleys, send them in to me. We're going to be talking about the history of Turok, the dinosaur hunter, you know, so we can do contemporary stuff as well. I think there's a lot of fun to be had here. I'll be probably changing some of the contact details, might even make an actual email address for once. I don't know if people are more or less likely to write to me if I have an email address rather than social media. I know since I left Twitter, there are people who are not on Instagram or Mastodon. I know their reach isn't as vast by comparison, but that's a choice I've made, and perhaps a curated email address is the way to go. But that's everything I'm going to say for now. Feel free to reach out, tell me what you think. Maybe you have ideas. So yeah, I'll leave it there, folks. So as always, stay safe and thanks for listening.
We are certain that Satanism exists. It's the practice of evil.
And following closely behind this car was this unidentified flying object.
You will prove the existence of the Bigfoot or Sasquatch by bringing in a body.